Donald Jr.'s emails are not fake news, while Trump's commission on voter fraud may not be real news. It all leaves you with one choice, the political junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Did the president's son attempt to collude with Russia? One thing's for sure, the emails he released are pretty stunning.
There was really no way for him to mistake that at least this was information that it was claimed was coming directly from somewhere in the Kremlin. We now have the first evidence of something that could be construed as collusion.
Plus, we'll examine President Trump's voter fraud commission. Is its purpose to fix the system or to satisfy false theories?
It's partly funny and partly alarming because there really are things that we need to fix about our election system. But this is part of a broader fight and a longer-term strategy to try to restrict the voting rights of many Americans.
And we'll talk to a successful political trailblazer in Illinois, whose career turned sour once he was appointed to the Senate.
You know, I knew Blagojevich very well. He knew me. But my family and I took a lot of heat. I'd be walking down the street and people will holler at me and say, hey, did you buy the Senate seat? And it was just a false impression of me.
It's all coming up on The Political Junkie, which starts right now.
You like Ike, I like Ike, everybody likes Ike.
For president.
And like to you, and lean to me, I don't care how you quote it.
Come on and vote for Kennedy, vote for Kennedy, and we'll come out on top.
Vote for Richard Nixon and Henry Cabot Lodge, cause they're the ones to lead the USA.
Thanks for joining us, and welcome to episode 187 of The Political Junkie. I'm Ken Rudin. Not long before Congress left for its July 4th break, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell promised he would have a health care bill ready to be considered and voted on. That, of course, did not happen. Now, with Congress back in session, McConnell announced on Tuesday that, hold on to your hats, folks, they're giving up the first 2 weeks of the August break to do what they need to do. Talk about sacrifices. As McConnell told it, it was the Democrats' fault.
Due to this unprecedented level of obstruction that we've been experiencing, for example, you may have noticed we had to get cloture yesterday on a district judge in Idaho. As of June 28th, there were 178 presidential nominations up here and only 46 confirmed. We're getting zero cooperation on the personnel part of the Senate's portfolio, which is confirming nominations. Therefore, we will be in session the first 2 weeks of August that we had originally anticipated not being here. We will be here.
Now, we've learned over the years not to underestimate the skills and persuasion tactics of McConnell. But as of this recording, the GOP still is not close to the 50 Senate votes needed to pass their alternative to Obamacare. Senator Ted Cruz is offering an amendment that would allow two distinct health care plans to be offered, one that would be cheaper for the young and healthy, and another more expensive plan for the elderly and those with pre-existing conditions. Methinks the more conservative holdouts could rally around the Cruz proposal, though it's hard to see how it could entice the five or six moderate Republican no votes to support the bill. There are some Republicans who say nothing will get done until the two parties work together on this. But right now it seems that McConnell is framing the possibility of bipartisanship only as a threat to get his party in line rather than a serious proposal. Last week, I talked about Donald Trump's Twitter attacks on Joe Scarborough and Mika Brzezinski, the co-host of MSNBC's Morning Joe program. Of course, Scarborough is also a former GOP congressman. So it was somewhat noteworthy on Tuesday night when he announced that he was leaving the Republican Party to become an independent. And that leads us to this week's trivia question. Who was the last Republican incumbent member of Congress who left the party and became an independent? Send your answer to trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll select a winner at random from the bunch. The winner will get a fabulous vintage Political Junkie button. Again, that's trivia at krpoliticaljunkie.com. We'll reveal the answer and winner of last week's trivia question later in the show, so stay tuned.
I'm over you. I'm over you. I'm over. I'm
One of the biggest question marks regarding the investigation into the 2016 election has been whether Russia colluded with Donald Trump campaign officials to get Trump elected. A lot of allegations, a lot of denials, a lot of dead ends. That is, perhaps, until now. Earlier this week, the New York Times reported on a meeting held in June of last year between Donald Trump Jr. and a Russian lawyer who allegedly had strong ties to the Kremlin. Trump Jr. had been promised information that would be damaging to Hillary Clinton in the campaign. Also attending the meeting at Trump Tower were Jared Kushner, Donald Trump's son-in-law, and Paul Manafort, Trump's campaign chair at the time. The story doesn't stop there. On Tuesday, with the Times about to release a stream of emails between Donald Jr. and the person who arranged the meetings, the presidential son decided to release them all on Twitter. And several of them, at least at first glance, were stunning. The sender of the email to Jr. said he had dirt on Clinton that, quote, would incriminate Hillary and her dealings with Russia and would be very useful to your father. The email went on to say, quote, this is obviously very high-level and sensitive information, but is part of Russia and its government support for Mr. Trump. The response from Donald Jr., quote, if it's what you say, I love it. Does the word collusion come to mind here? Anyway, for more on the story, we turn to our old friend Aaron Blake of the Washington Post, who's been following the drama. Aaron, it's great colluding with you once again.
It's nice to collude with you as well.
I think among the things that stunned me the most about this story, and of course this is a moving story and it could change, you know, minute by minute, is that Donald Jr. said, yes, I met with a Russian lawyer because of the promise of damaging stuff on Hillary Clinton, but ultimately I didn't get anything of value and it was a waste of my time. But that doesn't change the narrative that Trump was meeting with a Russian with potential explosive information in the middle of the campaign.
And a Russian, I would add, who, according to the emails he was getting from the publicist, was acting on behalf of the Russian government. That was mentioned explicitly at several points in those emails. There was really no way for him to mistake that at least this was information that it was claimed was coming directly from somewhere in the Kremlin. That's the key point here, I think. Look, the collusion investigation has always been somewhat in the realm of the hypothetical. It's always been somewhat of a circumstantial case based upon a number of meetings that the Trump team and the White House failed to disclose and only were dragged out of by the media, a number of claims during the campaign and things that were later revealed in media reports. This revelation has now moved this beyond the circumstantial into the questions about whether or not concrete actions were illegal. We now have the first kind of evidence of something that could be construed as collusion and will be examined as such by investigators. So this may not be the end of this. This may not be a crime necessarily, but this is the first kind of concrete piece of the puzzle that we've seen that really speaks to the possibility of collusion.
Well, you know, I mean, you were talking about the previous denials. CNN the other day put together this little montage of the president dismissing the thought of colluding with Russia. Let me just play that.
Every time Russia's brought up, they say, oh, Trump, what do I have to do with it? I have nothing to do with Russia, folks, okay?
There is no collusion between me and my campaign and the Russians.
But the entire thing has been a witch hunt, and there is no collusion between certainly myself and my campaign, but I can always speak for myself and the Russians, zero.
There has been no obstruction. There has been no collusion. There has been leaking by Comey, but there's been no collusion, no obstruction, and virtually everybody agrees to that.
Aaron, I don't think everybody agrees on that anymore, do they?
Well, they didn't at the time, and they certainly don't now. It's one thing to kind of offer a qualified denial of these things ever happening. It's another to offer those blanket denials that collusion ever happened. He didn't say, I wasn't aware of it if it happened. He said it didn't happen. Likewise, Donald Trump Jr. said back in March, he told the New York Times that he had never spoken with anybody from Russia about campaign matters, and that has turned out to be contradicted. So on some level, you know, whether or not this was actually a crime, the White House is just kind of digging itself further and further into a hole with their statements being later contradicted. it's difficult to take much of anything when they comment on the Russia matter seriously, just because they don't seem to choose their words very carefully, according to everything that we've seen so far.
And remember when Donald Jr. was first asked about these meetings, he said that he met with the Russian lawyer to talk about adoptions. Now, the thought of Donald Trump Jr., Jared Kushner, and Paul Manafort going to meet up with a person linked to the Kremlin in the middle of the campaign to talk about adoptions, that's beyond belief.
Yeah, that was always a really strange claim, and I think that a lot of people were poking holes in it right away for no other reason than that the Russian adoption issue is inextricably linked to the sanctions issue. Russian adoptions were halted because of the Magnitsky Act, which instituted sanctions because of human rights abuses. So anytime we're talking about Russian adoptions, we're also talking about sanctions. Those two are tied together. So that was a rather kind of incomplete denial from Donald Trump Jr. And I think there was a lot of skepticism that turned out to be warranted, because this meeting was not about adoptions from the very beginning. It was about opposition research. It may have become about adoptions because that's what the lawyer wanted to talk about, but it was set up as a means of gaining opposition research. And so that comment was, perhaps it could be technically true. It was highly, highly misleading.
So Donald Jr. was on Fox News Hannity program on Tuesday night, where the host asked him what he was thinking when he got the email offering negative information about Clinton.
Someone has information on our opponent. You know, things are going a million miles an hour. You know what it's like to be on a campaign. We just won Indiana, but we're talking about a contested convention. Things are going a million miles an hour again. And hey, wait a minute. I've heard about all these things, but maybe this is something. I should hear him out.
All right. So you spent a lot of time talking about it, and you actually said at one point that, hey, if it turns out to say what you say it is.
Of course.
What did you think it might be?
Listen, I'd been reading about scandals that people were probably underreporting for a long time. So maybe it was something that had to do with one of those things. I mean, this was perhaps involvement with the Russian government. So, you know, again, I didn't know there was any credibility. I didn't know if there's anything behind it. I can't vouch for the information. You know, someone sent me an email. I can't help what someone sends me. You know, I read it. I responded accordingly. And if there was something interesting there, I think it's pretty common.
What do you make of that answer, Aaron?
Well, he certainly can't help what people send him in an email, but he can help what he does in response to that. I think perhaps the best defense of him here is that he had no idea that that was not kosher. We even saw during the FBI director nominee Christopher Wray's hearings on Wednesday, he was asked about what people should do if they're contacted by a foreign government and pitched information or something like that, and he said that they should contact the FBI. So clearly this seems to be something that law enforcement agrees is not something that you should do. And his case is that he didn't see a problem with it, or he was kind of lost in the moment or something. I'm not sure that holds water as far as a legal defense.
And it doesn't only affect him. It affects Jared Kushner, too. Remember, in April, when he was filling out a form for security clearance, Kushner never mentioned any foreign contacts or meetings. And it was only a few weeks ago when Kushner filed a revised form that has come to light. He said it was a simple omission. I mean, how do you have Paul Manafort, Jared Kushner, and Donald Trump Jr. in a room with somebody linked to the Kremlin and not remember that? How is that possible?
I keep going back with this administration to kind of whether this is negligence or whether this is dishonesty. How much of this is, you know, the things they're saying that are later contradicted being oversights, and how much of it is deliberately putting out information that they know is false? You know, as a journalist, it's hard to know which it is. But I will say at this point, you know, the idea that they haven't done a forensic review of all of their meetings with anybody who could be construed as being tied to Russia and put that information out there in some way, trying to get all this bad information out there, which is usually how you handle matters in a scandal. The fact that they haven't done that leads me to believe that there's not a whole lot of plan here, or they have something to hide. So it's just a constant drip, drip, drip of information that makes it look like there's something going on here, even if we don't exactly know what that something is.
Well, the president has been pretty reticent lately. He hasn't said much or tweeted much other than said that my son is, you know, did things with complete transparency. And White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus, who was on, I guess, Fox News Sunday, called the meeting a nothing burger. And he said that it would eventually backfire on the Democrats. And this is something that White House spokesperson Sarah Huckabee Sanders also said.
The only thing I see inappropriate about the meeting was the people that leaked the information on the meeting after it was voluntarily disclosed.
But it wasn't voluntarily disclosed until the media went to them and reported, and then they suddenly changed their tune.
Yeah, that's another aspect here. The White House is praising Donald Trump Jr. for releasing these emails. The president has tweeted and released a statement to that effect. You know, this was not something that was done of his own volition. The New York Times had these emails. It published a story on them basically at the same time that Donald Trump Jr. released the emails. He wasn't going to release those emails if he didn't think that they were going to come out in another way. That's just not something you would have done. And so I think that it is a kind of strange claim for them to go out and pitch this as some kind of voluntary transparency play.
Well, on the opposite end of the spectrum, Virginia Senator Tim Kaine on Tuesday mentioned the word treason. Let's give it a listen.
We're now beyond obstruction of justice in terms of what's being investigated. This is moving into perjury, false statements, and even into potentially treason.
Now, I almost winced at that. I mean, that's not a word you kind of toss around lightly. What's your reaction to that?
Well, a couple things. Tim Kaine, of course, is generally a pretty understated guy. So I think I was with you, and I was kind of surprised that he would use those words. The other thing is that he's not on one of the committees that's investigating this matter, so he's got a little bit more leeway to kind of say what he thinks about this. You know, this has got to be really tempting for Democrats to pounce upon and really go hard at the idea of collusion or treason or conspiracy, taking a foreign contribution for a U.S. election, which is illegal, impeachment. There was articles of impeachment that were introduced by Congressman Brad Sherman on Wednesday. It's got to be really tempting to go down that road. Of course, we all have flashbacks to the late 90s when Republicans really overreached on impeaching President Clinton. And so I think Democrats are also going to want to be somewhat circumspect in how far they push and how hard they push while this story is still forming. But I will say that the Democratic base has to be pushing their members right now to really go hard after this and to really make an issue of this. And sometimes that pressure is not very easy to ignore.
At the same time, I would think, though, that the reaction from Republicans who have been pretty reticent to complain or criticize the president, that's what I'm really mostly interested in, to see if they start speaking up.
Yeah, and we really haven't seen it a whole lot, besides from the usual suspects, the McCains and the Grahams of the world. Senator Orrin Hatch, the Republican from Utah, the president pro tem of the Senate, he basically said it was a nothing burger, like Reince Priebus had said after all this stuff was put out there, and really defended it and suggested that it was much ado about nothing. I haven't seen a whole lot of senators taking that tack. They've mostly been quiet about it. But it's a situation where these Republican members of Congress have been confronted with so many controversies with Trump. I think a lot of them thought that the Access Hollywood tape was the end of it back during the campaign. It turned out it wasn't. The president is still around despite all the things that have happened during his presidency that have been controversial. And speaking out against him, while it may seem like an obvious call at the moment, it has a lot of downsides, potential downsides for these members. And so a lot of them are just kind of, I think, hoping that this will all pass and they won't have to weigh in on it.
You know, all of this came in the aftermath of Trump's meeting in Hamburg with Putin. And the president continues to say that no one really knows if Russia interfered with the U.S. elections, despite the conclusions by every American intelligence agency that it had. That's not going to ever change, is it?
I don't think so. And in fact, there was just a little while ago here, the president sat down with the Christian Broadcasting Network with Pat Robertson for an interview, and he basically suggested that Vladimir Putin may have in fact wanted Hillary Clinton to win the election and not him. He's never conceded that part of the intelligence community's conclusion about Russian hacking, that it was meant to help him. And so to say that after a day in which we have the Trump Jr. emails come out and this story really flare up, to kind of come out and be that defiant on another piece of the intelligence and disputing it is really, I think, a sign of things to come, that this episode hasn't changed his resolve as far as calling into question these conclusions about exactly what Russia did in the 2016 election.
By the way, last night I took a peek at your Twitter feed, at Aaron Blake, and I like that you reminded me of this speech from the president in June of 2016, around the time of his son's meeting with the Russian lawyer.
I love emails. You can't erase emails. You can't erase them. I love them.
I'm assuming Robert Mueller shares his love of emails.
There were many things that Donald Trump has thought were great until he didn't think that they were great. And usually it tends to revolve around the fact that it helped him in one case and then it didn't help him in another. A perfect example would be James Comey. At first, Trump hated him for coming out and kind of saying that there should be no criminal charges against Hillary Clinton. And then shortly before the election, James Comey makes another disclosure about more emails in the Clinton investigation. And suddenly James Comey is all right with Donald Trump. So Donald Trump's feelings about emails are probably just as fleeting as they were about James Comey.
Aaron Blake is a senior political reporter at The Washington Post, where he writes for The Fix. Aaron, thanks as always for your insight.
Good to talk to you, Ken.
I know I'm faking it, faking it. I'm not really faking it. This feeling of faking it. I still haven't shaken it, shaking it. I know I'm faking it. I'm not really faking it.
The fact that Donald Trump received 3 million votes fewer than Hillary Clinton has stuck in his craw since Election Day. But there was a reason for it, according to the president. Between 3 and 5 million people who voted illegally in California. Otherwise, he would have won the popular vote. Trump tweeted that shortly after the election, and his supporters backed him up. Here was Mike Pence on ABC's This Week with George Stephanopoulos back in December.
I think the American people find it very refreshing that they have a president who will tell them what's on his mind. And I think the connection that he made in the course
whether
of this campaign
true or not.
Is reflective of that. Well, they're going to tell him what he's going to say, what he believes to be true. And I know that he's always going to speak in that way as president.
And here was White House spokesperson Sean Spicer doing his best at a news briefing in January.
Does the president believe that millions voted illegally in this election? And what evidence do you have of widespread voter fraud in this election, if that's the case?
The president does believe that. He has stated that before. I think he stated his concerns of voter fraud and people voting illegally during the campaign. And he continues to maintain that belief based on studies and evidence that people have presented to him.
But exactly what evidence? Speaker Ryan today said there's no evidence. The National Association of Secretaries of State say that they don't agree with the president's assessment. What evidence do you have?
As I said, I think the president has believed that for a while based on studies and information he has.
Now the administration is taking this one step further. In May, Trump announced the formation of the Presidential Advisory Commission on Election Integrity. Its stated goal, to investigate claims of voter fraud. The commission's vice chair and head of it is Kris Kobach, the Secretary of State of Kansas, whom critics say is a leading advocate of putting up roadblocks to the right to vote. Most recently, the commission made news for requesting data from state election officials containing the names, addresses, dates of birth, and the last four digits of Social Security numbers of some 200 million voters. More than 20 states have rejected the request outright. The Mississippi Secretary of State, a Republican, reportedly said that those behind the request could, quote, go jump in the Gulf of Mexico. Kobach defended the commission's goal in an interview on Fox and Friends.
We've got 115 cases of known non-citizens who either got on our voter rolls in Kansas or who attempted to get on our voter rolls. And that's just the tip of the iceberg because you can't discover most of these cases. We had a statistical analysis done of our entire voter rolls, and it looks like we have as many as 18,000 cases of aliens on our voter rolls or people who attempted to get on the voter rolls and are not citizens. And we're just a small state, Brian, so if you, population-wise. So if you take those numbers, you extrapolate to a state like Texas or California, you're probably talking about hundreds of thousands of non-citizens on the voter rolls. And you're absolutely right. The media on the left wants to just ignore it and say, oh, there's no proof. No, we're presenting proof in federal court, but they don't want to put any attention on it.
The problem is, by most accounts, this allegation of massive voter fraud does not exist. At the minimum, there are few reported instances of people voting illegally. Michael Waldman is the president of the Brennan Center for Justice at the NYU School of Law, a nonpartisan public policy institute that focuses on the voting rights and expanded access to the ballot. Michael, it's great to have you on The Political Junkie.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Tell me what the official reason is for the creation of the commission, and tell me what you really think is behind it.
Well, the official reason is to investigate, as you say, the president's allegation that he really won the popular vote if you, quote, subtract the 3 to 5 million illegal voters that he insists voted. And he said not only in California, but in Virginia and New Hampshire, there were these millions of illegal voters. And this is, of course, widely ridiculed, widely derided, because there's no evidence that it's true, and plenty of evidence that it isn't true. And if you think about it, this is not something that happened 150 years ago or 100 years ago or 50 years ago. This is something that happened a few months ago, allegedly. Millions of alleged illegal voters, and nobody saw them. You know, not Fox News, not the Republican National Committee and all the lawyers they have out at polling places, not the police. They're not only illegal voters, they're special imaginary and invisible voters. So, you know, it's very special to find them. It's sort of partly funny and partly alarming, because it really is more of a pretext to try to create a condition for laws that make it harder for people to register, harder for people to vote. And that's what people are really worried about.
Well, do we think to follow up on that, do we think the commission is just to justify Trump's claim that he would have won the vote except for these millions of illegal voters who somehow all voted for Hillary Clinton? Or do we think it's, as some suggest, that it may be the beginning of a plan to put further roadblocks in the way of people registering and actually voting?
I'm certainly concerned about that. Trump's claims were sort of a cartoon version of arguments that we've heard in other contexts, in other places. People sort of stir the pot and spread these myths about voter misconduct, and it's used as a justification for a wave of laws in recent years to make it harder for many eligible voters to cast their ballot. And it is the case that the commission, as it is set up, unlike all the other panels that have looked at voting or similar issues in over the years, those are scrupulously bipartisan. You had one chaired by former President Jimmy Carter and former President Gerald Ford. You had the most recent one was chaired by Bob Bauer, who was Barack Obama's lawyer, and Ben Ginsburg, who was Mitt Romney's lawyer. And those kinds of panels have really made good recommendations. This one is stacked. It's chaired by Vice President Mike Pence, and the guiding force and the vice chair, as you say, is Chris Kobach. And it's filled with many of the most controversial folks involved in this push that many of us believe are aimed to restrict voting rights around the country. And, you know, it's a shame, because there really are things that we need to fix about our election system. There are things that are a bit of a mess, and there ought to be a way to address those, but this seems like setting up a pretext to say we need to, for example, require that people show their passport or birth certificate or naturalization papers in order to be able to register and vote. And a lot of people just don't have those documents.
I noticed from the response from the election officials after the commission was announced that the outrage from them was definitely bipartisan, Republicans as well as Democrats.
Yeah, it was interesting, and it was maybe a turning point, maybe a break point. There was so much overreach, not only in Trump's claims of a rigged election, but in the first move of this commission being a really ill-thought-through request for all this data, including Social Security numbers, with no protocols for keeping it secure or having it sent over email, ironically enough. I mean, there's all this kind of stuff that people have reacted to, and you're absolutely right that it has been Republican and Democratic officials who've said, look, there is not massive voter fraud, and this is a real risk to the privacy of our voters. And, you know, it may be that this is helping to forge a sensible, common sense force of left and right for changes that make sense, but pushing back against some of the wilder claims that we've heard.
The proponents of the commission have talked about, well, you know, a lot of this information is already publicly available. And of course, the president tweeted, you know, what are they trying to hide? So what's your understanding? I mean, I've seen things that said that 20 states have rejected the request outright. 44 states have rejected most of it, but they've given some information. What exactly are they giving the commission?
It is ironic, putting it mildly, for Donald Trump, who was the first presidential candidate or president in decades to refuse to release his tax returns, to say, what have they got to hide? But anyway, many states, as you say, have rejected it outright. There are a number of other states who have restrictions under their own laws on what kinds of information can be made available and under what circumstances. And for example, Kansas is a state where it is illegal to share the Social Security numbers of voters. So Secretary Kobach had to write to Kobach of the Voting Commission to tell him that it was illegal for Kansas to respond in that way. He couldn't do it. Some states make some of this stuff public in different ways. Maybe the voter has to give consent, or maybe it can be for the use of a campaign to do campaigning, but not for any other purpose. So this is kind of a patchwork of laws, and thus really in a lot of ways rendering the information pretty much useless. What we believe this commission wanted to do was to take the error-ridden and quite flawed federal list of citizens and compare it in some way to the sloppy and typo-filled voter rolls and say, voila, we have proof of massive numbers of illegal voters, and use that as a justification for these laws. And that would be, even under the best of circumstances, a bad idea, but they've made a total hash out of it.
Well, so many, I mean, for as long as I can remember, there's always been those anecdotal stories of, you know, the dead people voting for John F. Kennedy in Chicago in 1960, or the dead voters voting for Lyndon Johnson in the 1948 Senate race in Texas. So those stories about illegal and dead people voting have been around. How serious do you think this problem or this situation really, really is?
Well, it used to be a big problem. I wrote a book that just came out in paperback called The Fight to Vote, the history of voting and voting rights and voting fights in the country. And there really was, for many years, a lot of problems with, you know, especially political machines turning out voters improperly. The former governor of Louisiana once said, you know, when I die, bury me in Louisiana. I want to remain active in politics.
Right.
But in recent decades, really, for the last half century or so, it has grown more and more rare. And we really have very, very little evidence of significant voter fraud. And every academic study, every law enforcement study, every journalistic study, the Brennan Center for Justice, which I lead, did a study that found that you are more likely to be hit by lightning than to commit in-person voter impersonation at the polls. So, you know, it's sort of an urban myth. People are right to worry about election integrity. They're right to worry about making sure that people have secure elections and that people are eligible to vote and that only eligible voters get to vote. And it's also true that the voter registration rolls often contain duplications or typos or the names of dead people. It can be very hard to get yourself off of a voter registration list. The answer to that is not to disenfranchise people, but to modernize our system, to move to automatic and universal voter registration, where the government makes sure that you're on the rolls and that it's accurate. And that greatly increases the accuracy of the voter rolls, and it also adds tens of millions of people who are eligible to vote to be able to vote.
I noticed that three civil rights groups filed lawsuits against the White House on Monday. What's their argument, and what do you think their chances are of success?
Well, this sort of debacle of a commission has prompted lawsuits all over the place. You've got lawsuits by voters in the states. So the Brennan Center, which where I work, just yesterday sued on behalf of voters in Indiana, saying the request violated, and the intention of the local officials there to respond to it, violated Indiana law. There's a similar lawsuit in New Hampshire. There's also a lawsuit in Washington, D.C. federal court by the organization, the Electronic Privacy Information Center, that says that this whole request violates federal privacy law. And the commission is doing all kinds of things that suggest that it's not taking its openness and balance very seriously. Other groups, the Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights and ACLU, have made the point that it did not follow the open government laws in meeting and deciding to send this ridiculous request to the states. So it's not off to a roaring start, I guess I would say, but there is, again, a lot of damage that can be done because this is part of a broader fight and a longer-term strategy to try to restrict the voting rights of many Americans.
We talked about the lawsuits, but what about the chances of success against them? I mean, with all the arguments about privacy and the roadblocks to vote, what is the likelihood that these lawsuits can be successful?
I think a lot of these lawsuits have a very good chance of success. Already, the White House told the states, hey, whoa, hold up, don't send us that information. We just got sued, and we need the courts to rule on it. So they are taking it all pretty seriously. Ultimately, this is not a fight that's going to be won, I don't think, in the court of law, but in the court of public opinion. This is something where the public needs to say, we really care about our democracy. We care about everybody having the right to vote. We care about election integrity. And let's do some things about the real risks, such as voting machines that are subject to hacking by, say, oh, I don't know, Russia, and other real risks to election integrity. But let's not go off on kind of partisan and narrow efforts to disenfranchise people. Again, I think that the public response to what people saw as a data grab without precautions to guarantee that people's information would not be improperly used, the public's response and the response by local officials, professionals, many of them not partisan or Republicans or Democrats, all of that together is quite encouraging because it shows people are raising their voice and they care. And, you know, we've got a big election in 2018 certainly coming up nationwide. We know there have been attempts to hack into our system to upend our democracy in the last election. We ought to be able to work together to protect the real election integrity issues without this kind of silly nonsense that we're seeing right now. At least I think so.
Michael Waldman is the president of the Brennan Center for Justice at NYU School of Law, which fights for expanded access for voters to the ballot. Michael, thanks so much for being on the program.
My pleasure.
It's time to reveal the answer and winner of our latest trivia question, which was, who was the last member of the House who lost his seat because of redistricting and later ran for president? The answer, Bob Barr. The Democratic-controlled Georgia legislature threw him in with fellow Republican Congressman John Linder in 2002, a race Barr lost overwhelmingly. Later in 2008, Barr resurfaced as the Libertarian Party's presidential nominee. I should add that lots of people guessed Dennis Kucinich, the Ohio Democrat who lost his seat in another incumbent versus incumbent matchup in 2012. But he didn't run for president after he lost his House seat, as stipulated in the question. The correct answer is Bob Barr. And the randomly selected winner is Trudy Adams of Richmond, Virginia. Trudy wins the coveted political junkie button. And don't forget, we still have a scuttle button puzzle out there waiting to be solved. You can find that, as well as our political blogs, trivia questions, and the Political Junkie store, all on our website, krpoliticaljunkie.com. It's time for This Week in Political History. It was one of the most controversial Senate appointments in U.S. history.
So I'm here today to announce that I am appointing Roland Burris as the next United States Senator from Illinois.
It was not illegal, but everything about it stunk to high heaven. Yes, most states allow the governor to appoint someone to the U.S. Senate to fill a vacancy, but this governor was Illinois' Rod Blagojevich, who 3 weeks earlier was arrested on corruption charges, that he had tried to sell the Senate seat of Barack Obama, who a month before had been elected president, to the highest bidder. Blagojevich insisted that shouldn't taint the Burris appointment.
Please don't allow the allegations against me to taint this good and honest man.
Democrats were flabbergasted that the governor had the gumption to go ahead with an appointment anyway and insisted they would not seat any person Blagojevich chose. Ultimately, after a lot of anguish and roadblocks, the appointment stood, even as Blagojevich, less than a month later, was impeached and removed from office. He is to this day in federal prison. Burris enjoyed being a senator. He was the body's only African-American member, and he was proud of that. And yet, 8 years ago this week, Burris announced the only decision that made political sense.
And I'm making this decision. I was called to choose between spending my time raising funds or spending my time raising issues for my state. I believe that the business of the people of the state of Illinois should always come first. The business of our state should come first. And so today, I have returned to the place where my political journey began back in 1978, back to the south side of Chicago, back to my community and my constituency, to announce, my friends, that I will not be a candidate in the 2010 election.
It was a sad ending of a career that, in many respects, was filled with major accomplishments. He was elected controller in 1978, the first black ever to win statewide office in Illinois. He was reelected in 1982 and 1986. In 1990, he was elected state attorney general, the second African-American in the nation's history to win that post. He had some hiccups along the way, an early loss for state controller, 3 defeats for governor, 1 for the Senate, and 1 for mayor of Chicago, all totaled maybe more defeats than victories. But many of the wins were historic in nature. And I've invited him on the Political Junkie to talk about it all. Roland Burris, welcome to the program.
What an introduction, kids.
I know, I just encapsulated 50 years of your life in 2
Thank
seconds.
Thank you very much. You really put some history together there and playing those old tapes. I was good to hear my voice saying that I would not seek re-election, would not seek election in the United States Senate. And by the way, I was the first black in the history of America to be appointed to the United States Senate. So that's another little mark in history here.
When you were first elected to statewide office in 1978, that year, the lone African-American in the Senate had been defeated for re-election.
Ed Brooke.
Ed Brooke in 78 in Massachusetts, right? There were no black governors. That wouldn't happen until 1989 in Virginia.
Doug Wilder in Virginia.
And so it wasn't, shall we say, the golden era for black politicians, but yet you won statewide.
Yeah, that's because I was born and raised in downstate. I'd gone to Southern Illinois University in Carbondale, which was a downstate university, and then I lived in Chicago, and I was able to understand the makings of the great state of Illinois. We're the 5th largest state in the nation. I had studied political science. I'd gone to law school. I was at Howard University to enter into public service, because at the age of 15, Ken, I made 2 goals. One goal was to become a lawyer. The other goal was to become a statewide elected official of Illinois, and that's what I set out to do, and I made both of those.
In 1978, and even in later years as well, did the issue of race come up in the campaigns?
Oh, race was always there, absolutely. My Republican opponent back in the 78 elections started running commercials showing my picture in his commercials downstate to let the downstate voters know that I was black. And so it backfired on him. Most all the voters, downstate was familiar with Burris one way or the other, and the Burris family, because we had been a very successful family in my small hometown of Centralia, Illinois. And so it backfired on him. And because the white Republicans in downstate started to backlash and say that he's trying to play the race card against Burris. And there was a group of young men who most of them were Republicans, and they were for the JCs at the time, and they were located all over the state. And those JC buddies of mine, mainly Republicans, were saying, we're going to see that Burris get elected in the general election. Now, they weren't going to take, we have a closed primary, so they couldn't help me in the Democratic primary. But when I got the nomination in 1978, then my Republican supporters came out and voted for me. You can't get the votes that I got statewide without having Republican support, even though I was running as a Democrat. And that's because the people who knew me passed words on to their friends that this is a good person to elect for the overall benefit of Illinois because he's a public servant and look out for the interests. That was my agenda, Ken.
Well, you were often teased about the fact that you built this mausoleum for yourself with a tombstone that says Trailblazer. But let me expand on that a little bit.
No, I don't need to comment on that. I'm in the legal business. what I do is to do estate probate and wealth transfer and estate planning. So if I can't do my own planning, how can I help other people? So my wife and I built our mausoleum. Yes.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, let's face it, you were a political trailblazer in 78. How many blacks have been elected to statewide office before you? I think Ed Brooke of Massachusetts is the only one I could think of.
Well, now, there were a couple. You had a lieutenant governor in Colorado. You had a superintendent of public education in California. And I those names escape me at the moment.
Was it Brown?
There were a handful of us. I mean, as a matter of fact, we held a meeting while I was state comptroller in the early 80s, and there were five of us elected statewide. And four of us attended our annual conference here in Chicago at Johnson Publishing. We had a secretary of state of Michigan, secretary of state of Wisconsin. We had a treasurer of Connecticut and myself. Riles, the superintendent of education at that time, California, couldn't make it to our five-member convention. Meeting in a phone booth.
Exactly.
Right?
I was going to say the Ken Rudin fan club meeting in a phone booth. I'm just going to say that. What job did you enjoy the most? I mean, you had so many positions. What did you enjoy the most?
That's a great question. Because, I really was hoping to become governor of Illinois. I mean, because that's where you can really make the impact. I think the biggest headache was being attorney general because, you got 500 lawyers working for you. And they're doing all this in your name, and you're it. I mean, everything stops at the attorney general. There's nobody above him. And every suit that's filed, every legal action that's dealt with is dealt with in the name of the attorney general. And you're the lawyer for 13 million people, and then you're a lawyer for the state of Illinois. And it was just nightmarish. Of course, as comptroller, it was not that easy either because my biggest fear was somebody ripping off money from the state, and then I'm getting blamed for it. So, Ken, that was one of my biggest fears. But I just enjoyed public service. I mean, I wish I was still in the United States Senate. My 2 years there was just, they were a little controversial, but I know I made a difference.
Well, you wrote a book about your career, but mostly what I think of, not so much about your Senate tenure, the 2 years in tenure, but that the awful stuff that you had to go through after Blagojevich made the appointment, and then Dick Durbin and others saying, no, we're not going to seat any Democrat, anybody that Blagojevich appoints. That must have been tough on you and your family.
Yeah, well, it was awful, and it was led by your colleagues in the press. I mean, they transferred all the hatred for Blagojevich over to me because I had the audacity to accept the seat. And as you said earlier, I'd run for the United States Senate back in 1984. I mean, I wasn't just some novice out here somewhere. I'd served 20 years in Illinois government. So I knew public service. And I was also lobbying legally to get appointed to the Senate. My friends were calling the governor's office, writing letters to the governor's office and saying that Burris should be the person that you select. And based on that, it boiled down to his lawyers seeing a press conference held by a group of my supporters, suggesting that if you're going to appoint somebody to the Senate, the best person you can appoint to represent Illinois is Burris. And the governor's lawyers saw that and took it to him because Blagojevich beat me in the primary for governor in 2002. And I, had supported him to get him elected the first Democratic governor in Illinois in 24 years. We hadn't had a Democratic governor. And so, I knew Blagojevich very well. He knew me. And what I, did not know that the allegation that he was trying to sell the seat. Well, Ken, I was not trying to buy the seat. I had no responsibility for that, and I felt that that was the case. But my family and I took a lot of heat. I mean, the media was out to our home at 5:30 in the morning to 11 o'clock at night with those big generators. My neighbors were all disturbed. I mean, it was just a fiasco driven by the press. And what they never did say was that, you know, well, look, this guy has done 20 years. He's an honest public servant. And what's wrong with him taking the seat? But they did just the opposite.
I think of that scandal, the Blagojevich scandal, and it just feels that everyone he touched, he tarnished. I mean, Jesse Jackson Jr.'s career went down not only because of Blagojevich, but, I mean, his career was ruined. There were people who said that, you know, you had conversations with Blagojevich that you shouldn't have had.
Not me. I had a conversation with his brother. I never did talk to the governor. And his brother was talking about fundraising for his reelection campaign. It had nothing to do with the Senate seat. And that's why the press never did communicate that to the public. And they just said, well, Burris talked to the governor's brother. Yeah, about what? Well, fundraising for the governor's reelection campaign, which had nothing to do. And after I talked to my people, Ken, I even told him after one of the conversations with the governor's brother, well, I can't even raise money for the governor because I'm interested in getting an opponent to the Senate seat. So I can't raise money for him. I mean, that's just how foresighted and how committed I am to public ethics and not doing the wrong thing.
I heard a chuckle in your voice a few seconds ago, but does the whole episode pain you, or do you have good memories of it?
Oh, I have great memories of the Senate. It's just that the media and the public perception, because I'd been out of office, you know, for quite a while, and the people who did not know me as a public servant, you got their impression from me from the press. I'd be walking down the street and people would holler at me and say, hey, did you buy the Senate seat? How much did you pay for the seat? I mean, that was all from the media. And it was just a false impression of me taking the seat and having from Blagojevich, which he had the authority to do. And then you saw what the senators did, starting with Senator Feinstein, said, this is crazy. This man is qualified. This man got credentials. This man would be, and I could have run for the office had the media and the Democrats had not been so negative toward the situation. Of course, we lost the seat to Republican
Kirk. Right, Mark Kirk, you're right.
It's now back in the hands of the Democrats with Tammy Duckworth. She's now in the Senate seat. But the hardest part about that was how the press treated me and my family.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, you were in statewide office all those years.
Not a hint of a scandal.
Not a whiff of scandal. That's what I was going to say. And then to suddenly be badgered. That's why I mentioned it must have been tough on your family. You know, you mentioned earlier that you were going to you had this conference of five statewide African American meeting members, you know, statewide African officials. You could have had it in a phone booth. There's also, I heard there was also a meeting of Illinois governors who went to prison. They have a meeting every year or so about them too, right?
Well, no, we lost four of them.
What do you make of today's politics? Do you have any desire to be in the Senate at this time?
The answer is yes. Ken, I would love to be there today. We do have good representation for the first time in history. We have three blacks in the Senate, even one of them black Republican, Scott from South Carolina. He's a good guy,
right,
but
Tim
our
Scott.
Political philosophies are worlds apart. And you got Cory Booker from New Jersey and the former Attorney General of California, which is the second black lady to serve in the Senate. So for the first time in history,
Kamala Harris, right?
We have three senators, and that means that there have been 10 of us serving all together during the 200-plus years of the great state, a great country of America.
Well, let me go back to the mausoleum for one more second.
Sure.
What was your proudest moment in your long career? What was your proudest moment?
Oh, gosh, I've had so many of them. My deal was working with school children. You know, during my term of office, I went to hundreds of elementary, secondary, high schools and colleges. And was telling the Roland Burris story, and of course is run across even today. Older individuals said, "You came to my high school when I was a senior in high school, and I didn't know what I wanted to do. But because of you, I'm majoring in accounting." Or you go to one school teacher when I was at one school, and she says, "You know, I made up my mind to be a school teacher because you said, Mr. Burris, that educators impact eternity. You know, you never know how that mind is just going to go that you're educating." And so those are the things that I run across today, are those individuals that I reach. And that's kind of one of my, a few of the highlights that I had during my many years in public service.
And here's another highlight. You turn 80 next month.
It's a big party being planned for me in Chicago, Ken, on my 80th birthday, which is August 3rd. And they're going to celebrate it on the 5th at the Regency Hyatt in Chicago. And it's a celebration. They said Burris is going to reach 80, and we got to thank him for all of his commitment to public service is what my friends are doing. It's not that, I'm trying to throw a party or anything. It's my friends are putting this on for me.
And how do you rate being on the Political Junkie program as among your highest accomplishments and proudest moments?
Oh, well, to get dug up out of the archives, my kid, it's very interesting that someone would dig me up and say he's still alive.
Alive and well.
And just, waiting eagerly to talk to somebody about what happened. And asking people to buy the book. The book is The Man Who Stood Up to Be Seated, the controversial appointment of Roland Burris in the United States Senate. But it also tells my life story of growing up in a small southern Illinois town and being very goal-oriented and accomplishing every goal that I set.
Roland Burris served 12 years as Comptroller of Illinois, the first African-American elected statewide in the land of Lincoln. He was also elected Attorney General, and for better or worse, he served in the U.S. Senate, being appointed to Barack Obama's vacated seat by the less than honorable Governor Rod Blagojevich. His memoir, entitled The Man Who Stood Up to Be Seated, was published in 2014. Roland Burris, it was wonderful having you on The Political Junkie.
Ken, it was nice of you to think about me, and I really appreciate the interview. Thank you so much, and to all your listeners, I'm very grateful to still be here. I'm still trying to serve.
And happy birthday.
Thank you. Bless you.
Thank you so much. It was 8 years ago this week, on July 10th, 2009, that Roland Burris, Democrat from Illinois, announced he would not seek election to the Senate seat to which he had been appointed. You're listening to This Week in Political History on The Political Junkie.
They're gonna put you down for a while. You got to learn to grit your teeth and smile. Look a little on the funny, sunny side of life. Look a little on the sunny side.
That's it for this week's show. Be sure to check out our website for much more political content and to subscribe to our weekly newsletter. It's all at krpoliticaljunkie.com. If you've got comments, questions, or complaints, send an email to ken@krpoliticaljunkie.com. You can also tweet us at Ken Rudin and at Ken Rudin Junkie, or follow the show on Facebook. And you can follow my button of the day on Instagram at The Political Junkie. Political Junkie is distributed by PRX, the Public Radio Exchange. The show is produced by Devin Maverick Robbins, and Douglas Bell is our coordinating producer and engineer. I'm Ken Rudin. Thanks for listening. See you next week.
It's very hard to please the people every single time, but look a little on the sunny side. They're gonna put you down for a while. You got to learn to grit your teeth and smile. Look a little on the funny, sunny side of life. Look a little.